I want to share with you a true story titled Sunday Dinner. It's a story that was written by Corey Connors of Utah, and it appeared in Guidepost magazine several years ago. Again, it's titled Sunday Dinner. One Sunday afternoon, our family gathered around our big oak table for dinner. Soon my daughter Kate's laughter rose above the talk. "Grandma," she said, "you're silly." We all turned to see my mom delicately lifting to her mouth a small strand of peas on the blade of her knife. All but one pea made it, and everyone clapped. Then Mom told us the story behind her unorthodox technique. "When I was little," she said, "we didn't have much. It was the Depression. But we did have a table full of food because my father grew wonderful vegetables. Lots of hobos who had jumped from the train wandered onto our property looking for a meal. More often than not, an extra seat was pulled up at our dinner table. One summer afternoon, I was sweeping the kitchen floor when my father's voice came through the screen door. "Lizzie, set another plate. We have company tonight." Our guest paused in the doorway and dipped his head in a gesture of gratitude. "Looks like he doesn't speak much English," Dad said, "but he's hungry like we are. His name is Henry." When dinner was ready, Henry stood until we were all seated, then gently perched on the edge of his chair, his head bowed and his hat in his lap. The blessing was said and dishes were passed from hand to hand. We all waited, as was proper, for our guest to take the first bite. Henry must have been so hungry he didn't notice us watching him as he grabbed his knife. Carefully, he slid the blade into the pile of peas before him and then lifted a quivering row to his mouth without spilling a single pea. He was eating with his knife. I looked at my sister May and we covered our mouths to muffle our snickers. Henry took another knifeful and then another. My father, taking note of the glances we were exchanging, firmly set down his fork. He looked me in the eye, then took his knife and thrust it into the peas on his plate. Most of them fell off as he attempted to lift them to his mouth, but he continued until all the peas were gone. Dad never did use his fork that evening, because Henry didn't. It was one of my father's silent lessons in acceptance. He understood the need for this man to maintain his dignity, to feel comfortable in a strange place with people of different customs. Even at my young age, I understood the greatness of my father's simple act of humility and brotherhood. Mom paused, looked at her grandchildren, and winked as she plowed her knife into a mountain of peas. It's called Sunday Dinner, and it's an interesting story that does illustrate, I think, an act of humility, an act of brotherhood, an act of service in a very unique way. Humility is a subject that many have written about and spoken about for centuries. Quotes can be found from many individuals expounding various aspects of this quality of character called humility. Many of those quotes are interesting. Some point to problems that keep people from seeing the cause of true humility. Some quotes come close to giving the real key to humility, but no secular writer that I have read actually ever stated clearly the real key to humility. I haven't found it just in any secular writings anywhere. The quality of humility is essential to becoming a member of the family of God, as well as to being an effective servant of God today in this life. The quality of humility is vital. It is so important. But how do we develop that? How does that come about? What must be done? What has to be learned for one to become humble? The sermon is really about what is the key to humility. What is the key to humility? There is a clue in the story that I just told you about the key to humility. When we look at the subject of humility, it's helpful to understand what it is or how it's defined. What is it that we're actually seeking, that we want to grow in? Well, what really is it? Listen to this definition from Webster's New World College Dictionary. It defines humility this way: the state or quality of being humble, the absence of pride or self-assertion. And then it defines humble this way: having or showing a consciousness of one's defects or shortcomings, not proud, not self-assertive, modest. Did you catch that about both definitions? There was something the same in both of those definitions of both humility and humble. It's interesting that in both of those words or definitions for humility and for humble, they both refer to self-assertion. They both use the term self-asserting or self-assertion. So what does the dictionary mean by that, or say that self-assertion is? It defines self-assertion as the act of demanding recognition for oneself or of insisting upon one's rights, claims, etc. Interesting definition of self-assertion. I'd like you to turn to Acts chapter 16 with me. I think we would all agree that demanding recognition for oneself would not fit with true humility. But what about insisting on one's rights? Are all acts of insisting upon our rights an indication of lack of humility? What about Acts 16? And here in verse 35, Paul and Silas were thrown into prison. They were beaten. They were thrown into prison. And then they were about to be released. Acts 16, verse 35. When it was day, the magistrates sent the officers saying, "Let those men go." So the keeper of the prison reported these words to Paul, saying, "The magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace." But Paul said to them, "They have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans, and have thrown us into prison. And now do they put us out secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and get us out." Or in chapter 22, and verse 25 through 26. Acts 22 and verse 25. "And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, 'Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?' When the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, 'Take care what you do, for this man is a Roman.'" Was Paul's demanding of his rights for proper treatment as a Roman citizen, was that an example of lack of humility, according to the definition? Here he was asserting those rights. He was insisting to be treated equitably as a Roman citizen, but he wasn't seeking preferential treatment above everybody else. Every once in a while you read in the news, we read one example not long ago in a nearby city, a legislator who was stopped for speeding and tried to get out of any responsibility for the ticket by using, and this was all on tape, "Don't you know who I am? Don't you know who I am?" And the officer did, but still issued the ticket anyway. So Paul was not demanding preferential treatment because he had some high exalted opinion of his own importance. All Roman citizens, no matter their station in life, high or low, had certain rights. And Paul was just seeking to be treated equitably. And so it's interesting that a point we can take from Paul's example is that human beings trying to define humility and humble don't always understand what true humility is or what produces it. They often miss the mark in trying to come up with human definitions of it. But the definition that I read, the state or quality of being humble, absence of pride or self-assertion, does touch on an important truth. And that is that humility cannot coexist. It cannot coexist with an exalted idea of one's own importance or abilities. The Bible calls it the pride of life. True humility can't exist alongside of being filled with the pride of life. Let's read in 1 John 2. 1 John 2. It's interesting that Webster's defines pride as an unduly high opinion of oneself. An unduly high opinion. 1 John 2 and verses 15 and 16. Notice the categories, the three categories that are mentioned here. Beginning in verse 15, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. These three categories are all based on some form of self-exaltation, some form of self-gratification. When you look at each one of those, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, they're all based on some form of self-exaltation, each one of them. And John cautions against that. Have you ever heard the term putting up a facade or having a facade of humility? We usually mean that the person is only putting on the appearance of humility. Sometimes we call it putting on airs or putting on a facade. Certainly God knows the difference between what's really going on inside and just what's happening on the outside. God knows the difference. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 16. Good reminder here of how God looks at this subject. 1 Samuel chapter 16. We know that the outward appearance is very important to human beings, to us at times. And man tends to look on the outward appearance first and foremost, how a thing looks, how a person looks. But that's not what God looks on first. And the Bible gives a number of examples. One of them is found here in the account concerning Samuel being sent to Jesse, father of David, to select a king for Israel. 1 Samuel 16, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I am sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons. So Jesse went. And notice verse 6. So it was when they came that he looked at Eliab, apparently Jesse's oldest son, and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. When Samuel saw Eliab, he looked, and he was certain this was the one by his appearance. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. But we human beings are so physically motivated, and part of the process of conversion is to be motivated, again, by the Spirit of God and the fruits of God's Spirit, but we still, as human beings, are physically motivated. And the inclination of human nature can be to put on copying someone who is known as a humble person. What did they do that made them humble? What is it that they do? What are their actions? And if people focus on what they see, a person that they think is humble, what they see them do. And they focus just on that instead of trying to understand the motivation of the heart and what's really going on inside of those who are truly humble. There is a difference. It doesn't take God's Spirit to recognize that sometimes a person is just trying to act humble. We've all probably run into or met or known people like that, instead of actually being humble. If you've ever read the classic novel Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, there's a line where she has Mr. Darcy saying, nothing is more deceitful than the appearance of humility. Nothing is more deceitful than the appearance of humility. You're also maybe familiar with the name Frank Lloyd Wright, a well-known architect. Many of his buildings are up around the Milwaukee area. He has some in Pennsylvania, I think in Illinois as well. Frank Lloyd Wright was known for his arrogance and an interesting personality. He had an interesting statement about humility. He said, early in my career, I had to choose between an honest arrogance and a hypocritical humility. He said, I deliberately chose an honest arrogance, and I've never been sorry. At least he was honest about it. He was arrogant, and he knew it, and he conducted himself that way. He felt that was better than being arrogant and hiding it under a facade of humility. Having a facade of humility is a problem that any of us could have if we don't understand what the key to true humility is. A man by the name of Dr. David Wells, a research fellow at Yale Divinity School, wrote this, humility has nothing to do with depreciating ourselves and our gifts in ways we know to be untrue. Even humble attitudes can be masks of pride. So that's another side of the coin that sometimes people go to deny our talents and abilities is not being humble. That's not what humility is. Humility is demonstrated by how we use those talents and abilities, the spirit and attitude that we put them to work in, the motivation, what's, again, inside our mind and heart. In Colossians 3, verse 12, what does this in our lives? How does this happen? Colossians 3 and verse 12. Colossians 3, verse 12, there's this statement. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. Put on humility. Doesn't mean having a facade of humility, but it means clothe ourselves, grow in that. What does that in your life? What does that in our lives? Or 1 Peter 5 and verse 5. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 5. We find this statement. And it's addressed, interestingly enough, first to younger people. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you, young and old, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. One of the times in our lives when we can grow the most spiritually is when we've been humbled. It can be a trial, it can be an illness, it can be correction, it can be any number of things. But when we've been humbled is a time when we can grow the most spiritually. God gives more of His grace, the help of His Spirit. But we're instructed to be clothed with humility. What produces that? What produces being clothed with humility? Again, a lot of authors have written about this topic and have some good points about it. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, a great man is always willing to be little. Interesting story about Abraham Lincoln, who once got caught up in a situation where he wanted to please, kind of cater to a politician friend of his. So he issued a command based on this man's advice to transfer certain regiments of troops. When the Secretary of War, Edward Stanton, got that order, he refused to carry it out. He said that the president was a fool. And Lincoln was told what Stanton had said, and he replied, well, if Stanton said I'm a fool, then I must be, for he is nearly always right. I'll see for myself. And as the two men, so he did. He went to talk to Edward Stanton. As the two men talked, the president quickly realized that his decision was a serious mistake. Without hesitation, he withdrew it. Emerson said, again, a great man is always willing to be little. And Abraham Lincoln certainly had that quality. Albert Einstein said this, a true genius admits that he or she knows nothing. A true genius admits that he or she knows nothing. There are good points in these quotes, and that last one is very similar to the words spoken by Samuel to Saul in 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel chapter 15. And in verse 17. Very wise words from Samuel to Saul. So Samuel said to Saul, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel?" But he knew that Saul did not stay little in his own eyes. So he didn't have the key to true humility. Saul didn't have the key to true humility. The bottom line is that if a person has, keeps, and practices the key to true humility, he will never turn away from being humble if he understands and practices the key to true humility. Another quote, Epictetus, a Greek philosopher who lived from AD 55 to 135, wrote this. He said, "If anyone tells you that a certain person speaks ill of you, do not make excuses about what is said of you, but answer, 'He was ignorant of my other faults, else he would not have mentioned only these alone.'" That one probably strikes close to home for all of us, because we know our faults and our weaknesses better than anybody else. Sometimes, again, more than we would like to admit. How do we respond when we've been criticized, maybe constructive criticism, or been challenged in some way, had our self challenged? How do we respond to that? We really begin dealing with the source and the cause of true humility when we begin dealing with the subject of self. When we really think and meditate on and think about the subject of self. And again, once again, many writers have recognized that. Martin Luther wrote this, "True humility does not know that it is humble. If it did, it would be proud from thinking about so fine a virtue." Hermann Hesse, a German poet, novelist, and painter, lived in the late 1800s up until about 1960, wrote, "I realize today nothing in the world is more distasteful to a man than to take the path that leads to himself." Nothing more distasteful than to take the path that leads to himself. Charles Spurgeon, 19th century British preacher, said, "We are not worthy to unloose the laces of Jesus' shoes, because if we do, we begin to say to ourselves, 'What great folks we are, we have been allowed to loose the laces of the Lord's sandals.' If we do not tell somebody else about it with many exultations, we at least tell ourselves about it and feel that we are something after all and ought to be held in no small repute." It's an interesting outlook on service. C.S. Lewis, well-known religious writer, wrote, "True humility is not thinking less of yourself, it is thinking of yourself less." And then finally, Madeleine L'Engle, an American writer, wrote, "Humility is throwing oneself away in complete concentration on something or someone else." Throwing oneself away in complete concentration on something or someone else. These quotes begin dealing with the point that leads to the key to true humility and how to be clothed with true humility. A humble mind does not dwell on the self. A prideful, self-assertive mind does. Another interesting thing about humility is that it cannot be pursued as a goal all by itself. But to be clothed with humility, as Peter instructed, we have to seek something else, the key to humility. The key to true humility. If we attain the key, God says we'll be clothed with humility. And the changes have to be in our hearts and mind, not just in our actions. Not just in what we do. We certainly want to avoid adopting the appearance of humility just for appearance sake, the facade of humility. But we can't just say, "I've got to become humble And so I'm going to start doing what humble people do. You know, it just doesn't work that way with true humility. What are truly humble people like? Think about, what is a truly humble person like? We all want to be clothed with humility. And what would be the outstanding example that you would think of? Well, of course, it would be the example of Jesus Christ. Every Passover, we teach and remind ourselves about Christ's example of humility in washing his disciples' feet. That was a true act of humility. And look at some other verses leading up to that. Things that Christ said that he was. John 13 and verse 13. Notice the things that Christ said he was. John 13, verse 13. He said, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am." Christ said he was their teacher and their Lord. In John 8, verse 58, we back up a little bit. John 8, verse 58, Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." That is, Jesus said he was the I am who spoke to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses, etc. He made it plain to them who he was. In Ephesians 3, verse 9, we're reminded about this. Ephesians 3 and verse 9. "And to make all see," Paul wrote, "what is the fellowship of the mystery, which from the beginning of the ages has been hidden in God, who created all things through Jesus Christ." The Creator. Christ taught us, either by his own words or the inspiration of Paul, that and his disciples, that he was their teacher and Lord. He was the I Am who spoke to the patriarchs of the Old Testament. He was their Creator. And as a human being, he could have taken the approach, well, I'm too big to be washing their feet. You know, that's something, you know, that I can do bigger things. There's an interesting story, kind of parallel to that, about George Washington. On one occasion, George Washington was riding near Washington City on horseback with a group of friends. And they came to a place where they had to leap over a stone wall, around a farmer's property. And in the process of doing that, one of their horses knocked off a number of stones from the wall, at that point in the wall. And Washington stopped and said, "Well, we ought to replace those." And his friend said, "Oh, let the farmer take care of it. He'll do it." But Washington still didn't feel right about that. And so when the riding group was done, he went back to where that wall was. He found the wall and he dismounted and he carefully replaced and put back each of the stones. When he came back to join the group, his riding companions had seen, I guess, from a distance, saw what he did. And one of them said to him, "You're too big to do that." And Washington's only response was, "On the contrary, I am the right size. I am the right size." It's interesting that in this case, Washington was clearly motivated by a genuine outgoing concern for this farmer and his property. He was ordinary man, and Washington showed him the right kind of concern. What was Christ's motivation for washing his disciples' feet? What was the motivation? Was it to show them how humble he was? Or was he showing them something greater? What was on his mind that night? Let's read in John 13. John chapter 13 again. We read in verse 1. "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father," he knew. Christ knew that when this day was successfully accomplished by his death, by his dying without sin, that he would be returning to the right hand of the Father after 3 days and three nights. And then the verse goes on to say, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. We believe that the greatest quality of God's nature and of Jesus Christ's nature is their love. And it's interesting that God is called love, that here Jesus' mind was filled with the love he had for his disciples. His mind was filled with that love. It was his love for them that motivated him to wash their feet. That's why he did that. That's why he washed their feet. It was indeed an act of humility motivated by true love for them. And that gets to the key to humility. The key to his humility was the depth of his love for them. That's the key to humility. It's not something we can just strive to put on all on our own. I want to be humble. I want to do humble things or humble-looking things. It comes from being filled with and motivated by godly love. The key to true humility is being filled with and motivated by godly love. Genuine, outgoing concern for the needs and welfare of others. People who truly love others are humble. They are not motivated by self-seeking. That was the point of the story at the beginning of the sermon. A man who was motivated by concern for a stranger humbled himself what he did so as not to make this stranger feel out of place or embarrass him. And so he humbled himself by eating with his knife. Simple act of humility and love, showing concern for this other man. In Galatians 5, verse 13 and 14. Galatians chapter 5. And verses 13 and 14. For you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. When a truly humble person sees someone in need, they try to help. It doesn't matter who it is or what their station in life may be, or they're not too big to help. No one and nothing is beneath them. They're just willing to help. And humility results. We grow in humility from being filled with that kind of love and by growing in that kind of love. Philippians chapter 2 and verses 1 through 5. Philippians chapter 2 and verses 1 through 5. Paul wrote, therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than himself. Compare that with that definition of humility and humble that Webster's had about self-assertive, wanting to have the preeminence. It's an interesting definition, especially when you compare that with verse 3. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. So Paul reminds us that those who truly love also have their minds on the needs of others and have that kind of concern for them, not only on pleasing the self. Godly love for others is the true key to humility. That's the key, and that's the key that so many in writing about humility and just in the authors of the world have good points about humility. They can be instructive, and they teach us a number of things, but I've never seen anybody that gets to that point as the Bible does. That godly love for others is the true key to humility. That's a fruit of God's Spirit. As we grow in conversion and grow in God's Spirit, well, then we can also grow in humility. It's not something we just seek on our own, but it's something that God clothes us with as we grow in godly love. So let's understand again the key to true humility. Ask God for help to grow in godly love so that we can also have and grow in the key to true humility.